Hi everyone, thank you for coming. I also like to thank HKV for inviting me to this wonderful event, and it's a really wonderful place to come to, full of intellectual generosity and professionalism, so it's wonderful to be here, thank you. I've been asked to comment on the Slavs and Tatar lecture and some of the images and link them up to some of the sort of overarching topics of this event, namely time, temporality, and not least the now. And I'll try to do that. It will take the form of a 20-minute lecture that I hope will kick us off to a great discussion afterwards, which is sort of the goal of the whole thing, I think. Anyway, here we go. In Greek mythology, there's a recurring image of a young man who has no hair at the back of his head, but a long lock at the front. To catch him, you have to seize hold of his hair, but when he's past you, it's already too late. You end up grasping at his bald, shaven head. His name is Kairos, and he's the moment to be seized, the right moment for action, for intervention, for speaking up, for seizing an opportunity. If it makes sense to talk about the temporal dimension, which has not received the attention it deserves, and it probably doesn't make sense, but you have to bear with me on this, I would like to suggest that the most underrated temporal dimension in our current temporal economy or ecology is the now. First, this might seem like an absurd claim. One of the most often cited signatures of our time is the so-called tyranny of the moment, which forces us to stack ever more tasks, appointments, and activities into an ever smaller time span, often referred to as the time squeeze or the time crunch. Additionally, more and more pressure is put on the now due to the developments in media and communications technology, producing breaking news, liveness, simultaneity, synchronizing the lives of billions of people every second. Both historians and social scientists seem to agree that global civilization is haunted by a kind of presentism, in which both the past and the future are spaces of experience as well as our horizons for expectation, to use Reinhard Koselleck's terms, are eclipsed by an ever-expanding present, an inflated now. But is this really all there is to say about the now, which is undeniably at the same time the indispensable temporal framework for all our experiences, decisions, and actions? How can we make decisions about the future? How can we draw lessons from the past? How can we experience and even bring about historical change except under the temporal condition of the now? And not least, why should we accept the media and technologic that tries to impose on us the idea that the now is almost completely devoid of extension and can be reduced to a kind of media-induced liveness, which lasts only as long as a specific kind of communication can keep our attention? Mostly a matter of seconds, in best case, minutes. This project at Haus der Kultur in der Welt, and more particularly this event, is, at least as I see it, an attempt to explore the extensions of the now, but horizontally and vertically, as it were, both in time and space. The lecture just witnessed by Slavs and Tatars imagines the possibility of a very different now from the one I just described, both longer, broader, and thicker, if you like, and thus infinitely richer both in experiences from the past and in possibilities for the future. However, we are not the first to have had similar worries, not the first to have seen the now shrink and dissolve, become ungraspable and always non-existent. Under completely different media, historical, and technological conditions, in the famous 11th book of his Confessions, St. Augustine, then Bishop of Hippo in North Africa, discusses the three dimensions of time, past, present, and future. That is, he has sincere doubts if the temporal dimension that we call the present and now can really exist. How long does the present last, Augustine asks. 100 years, he suggests, thus anticipating the organizers of this event by almost 2 centuries. But no, 100 years seems too long, he concludes, and he goes on to experiment with other durations, other time spans, a year, a day, finally an hour. In this way, in Augustine's philosophical imagination, the present shrinks into what we might call a moment, or in German, ein Augenblick, the blink of an eye. a movement anticipating in a strange way what we today often refer to as acceleration, or more precisely social acceleration, in the words of the sociologist Hartmut Rosa, or simply in ordinary language, that time goes faster. Of course it doesn't really, but that in this case seems less important. So in Augustine's Confessions, the now all but disappears. What remains is nothing but a line or a border separating the past from the future, or put differently, a point of passage, where the time moves from the past into the future, but which in itself has no extension, neither in time nor in space. Among our most important, I would claim, theoretical and critical tasks today is to reconfigure, reframe the now, our now, not as a line or a border, but as what the German philosopher Edmund Husserl famously called an extensional field, ein Zeitfeld, in which past and future are ever-present, either as memories, archives, written and material remnants, or as hopes, fears, plans, and anticipations in all shapes and forms. So we have to find our way back to the long now, as well as to the thick now, in order to find room for reflection, decision, and action. And this is, in my opinion, what Slavs and Tartars are contributing to with their lecture and performance. Reframing, reconfiguring, restaging the now. A very different now from the one we're used to from our daily lives. A now which isn't just a flicker or a glimpse, but which has extension and thickness, which has multiple layers underneath the ever-changing surface. Excuse me. So, to the idea of the now as a point corresponds another idea also inspired by Euclidean geometry of time as a line, a timeline as we're used to calling it, which is really an infinite succession of nows, of moments extending some billions of years into the past as well as endlessly into the future. When this empty, absolute, and mathematical time, invented by Isaac Newton at the end of the 17th century, was taken up as a principle for organizing human events, actions, and experiences, what we usually call history, it came to be named progress. Of course, there were other possible names, such as Bildung in German or Perfektibilité in French, but in essence, they were the same name for linear, homogeneous, progressive, teleological time about to take mankind from barbarism in different forms to civilization. Universal history, another word for the same kind of movement as was invented by German thinkers like Johann Gottfried Herder and Georg Friedrich Hegel, started in the Far Orient, where the infancy of mankind took place, set forth in the Near Orient, where mankind spent its childhood, then it moved on to Egypt, where mankind entered its youth, etc. This life, which is at the same time ontogenetic and phylogenetic, individual and collective, culminates in Europe in the 19th century, if we are to believe Hegel. According to him, nations across the globe are never part of the same now. More precisely, non-Europeans are never in sync with their European counterparts. That is, they don't share the same time. They're not at the same level or stage of civilization, but are lagging hopelessly behind, unable to keep step or to catch up. They are at the same time, but not in the same time. They are what the Germans refer to as ungleichzeitig, out of sync, or in the words of the anthropologist Johannes Fabian, they are denied coevalness, which you might as well call nowness. This denial of coevalness applied to non-European cultures is also what the literary historian and critic Edward Said, a key figure as you've just seen in the lecture by Slavs and Tartars, attributes to those scholars, philologists, archaeologists, and historians who he famously labeled Orientalists. Not in the descriptive historical meaning, obviously, but this in a decidedly pejorative sense. In his 1978 bestseller, he shows how the linearity and teleology of Western historical time, of progress, was applied to the Near and the Middle East by Anglo-American Orientalists like Edward Lane and William Jones, to the effect that non-Europeans were seen either as delayed in their civilizing process, still like children, or living outside time altogether in a kind of pre-civilization paradise. In both cases, they were denied the opportunity to take part in history and decide and shape their own fate. In some cases, Said argued, these scholars even furnished the colonialist authorities with the arguments and knowledge they needed to be successful in their domination of the colonized, as we just heard from Payam. So the question remains, does Said's vehement and often unfair attack on the tradition in Western scholarship contribute to reconfiguring how we think about historical time, and more precisely, how we think about the now? Slavs and Tartars seems to think that it doesn't. And indeed, at the closer inspection, Said's attack is itself as much a vehicle for the Western myth of linear theological time as the Orientalism he's attacking. The difference is only that in Said, history in the West no longer advances toward a pinnacle of civilization, when liberty, democracy, and peace will reign supreme, but on the contrary, toward a pinnacle of imperialism, ethnocentrism, and racism. So there are narratives and counter-narratives. Orientalism, as theorized by Said, mounted a convincing and extremely successful counter-narrative to the Western myth of progress. Both narrative and counter-narrative, however, organize time in much the same way. Slavs and Tartars, by contrast, doesn't start with a narrative, but with an archive. That is an archive that is not yet an archive, but a mass of historical material of various kinds, books, texts, images, lives, events, places. And they set out to explore this material, investigate it, even excavate it, to ensure themselves that they are not reproducing narratives or counter-narratives from the quasi-mythological, naturalized complex of Orientalism. They give their subject a strong reflexive element. They study the East in the East, the archives of Russian Orientalism. So I just, when Gwen was speaking, I just understood that there's a difference between political scientists and historians, because you were sort of concerned about the lack of time in political science. I would be more concerned about the lack of space in history. So that is an interesting disciplinary difference, I think. But we're both concerned. That's a good thing. So, to move on, there's an old and often repeated quote that some claim goes back to the English 17th century philosopher John Locke, whereas others attributed to lesser-known thinkers and writers as Samuel Purkas or Isaac Vossius. This attribution is not our concern. The quote itself, however, is, and it goes as follows. History has two eyes. They are chronology and geography. And if history, mostly imagined as a woman, often identified as Cleo, the Greek muse, is not able to use both of her eyes for some reason or another, she's as good as blind. So the Slavs and Tartars' performance can be perceived as an attempt at curing a kind of blindness in the Western experience of history. At least since the end of the 18th century, history has been peering helplessly at the past with only one good eye. This good eye, of course, is chronology, which has enabled historians to create grand narratives about the rise of the Western world, the nation-state, democracy, and freedom. Every now and again, a historian has come around, like to discuss Said, who actually does have some sight left, albeit quite poor, in his other eye, the eye of geography, but not enough, it seems, to give his vision the necessary balance and depth. Of course, this is not quite true, not anymore. Lately, not only history, but several disciplines and fields of knowledge in the humanities and social sciences have been exposed to what often is referred to as a spatial turn, a return of space, eine Wiederkehr des Raumes, as the great historian of Eastern Europe here in Berlin, Karl Schlügel, has famously called it. And it is interesting to note that also in the case of Slavs and Tartars, the deep knowledge of the Eurasian continent from Berlin to Beijing is what enables them to explore alternate histories, other narratives, which serves to counter both the linear narrative of Western civilization and the just as linear, though inverse, narrative of Orientalism. By opening up new spaces, often completely unknown to Western historical imagination, they also open up new times. Who in this room, who's not a specialist in Russian history, could honestly claim any in-depth or even superficial knowledge of Tatarstan and its capital Kazan I did that well, I think, which in the 19th century became the powerhouse of Russian Orientalism. Who has really taken in the historical importance of the Great Steppe, the enormous open areas of grasslands and savannas connecting Europe, Central East and South Asia, as well as the Middle East, and the home of powerful nomadic tribes such as the Huns and the Mongols, and not least the site of what Slavs and Tatars aptly calls Russia's self-colonization or internal colonization. And last but not least, as we heard from Gwen Sasa at the end, the Crimean Peninsula, which offered Russia both its first Orient and its main link to Greek and Western antiquity, and where both Greek ruins and plants of different geographic origins manifest another physical but also historical and temporal layer underneath the surface of political history. When all these new spaces, geographical, topographical, archaeological, ecological, are laid open, made accessible for our historical imagination, as expansions or even extensions of the now, something also happens to time. Distributed across space, time loses its singularity and its homogeneity, maybe even its linearity, at least its directionality. The Hegelian conjunction of time and space, that the goal of history lies in Western Europe, even in Germany, can no longer be upheld. Instead, we discover multiple parallel times unfolding in different geographical spaces, the time of the Russian Empire, for which the rhythms are set by advances and setbacks of self-colonization, the time of the Great Steppe, whose movements follow the movements of the nomadic tribes, the time of the Crimean Peninsula, once the garden of the Russian Empire, where the natural history of plants create another historical and temporal layer, different from and maybe even deeper and slower than the layer of political events, which recently took such a dramatic turn. Opening up other geographical spaces, and this is going to be my last point, and thus exposing other temporal lines or layers is in itself not enough. If the goal is to expand and extend the now, in the sense of our common collective now, these multiple spaces and times also have to be brought into our present historical experience or imagination, be merged with our own ongoing struggles to historicize ourselves. In the performance by Slavs and Tatars, the exploration of alternate geographic spaces is inextricably linked to the exploration of another kind of space. As you've all seen, that's the space of the page, or the space of the book, or even the space of the slide. Their self-proclaimed obsession with books, which includes, I would presume, both books they come across and books they produce themselves, cannot, at least as I see it, be separated from their fascination with geographical space. Because the book, and by extension the page and the slide, can contain, hold, or accommodate the multiplicity of objects which originate from completely different historical contexts, much like a geographical landscape. In this way, the space of the book is able to reproduce the simultaneity of the non-simultaneous, die Gleichzeitigkeit des Ungleichzeitigen, which is contained in any geographical and topographical landscape, but which do not and cannot fit into the linear succession of the written or the spoken word, the narrative, or the lecture. So most of the slides you've been watching are indeed manifestations of this, manifestations of the simultaneity of the non-simultaneous, when the simultaneity of the slide space, if you like, combines and brings together elements, texts, and images, which are completely non-simultaneous, in the sense that they come from completely different historical contexts, old or new, near or far, to the extent that, as you've just seen, Charlie Sheen becomes an illustration of the work of 19th century Russian Orientalists. Which is a surprising thing, but surprising place to see Charlie Sheen, I think. In this way, by means of these slides, and of course the lecture that accompany them, new, different, and innovative combinations of elements and objects are brought into the now, into our now, extending and expanding it, not into a point or a line, but into a multi-layered time field in which the past lingers on and the future precedes itself, and we, the spectators, are turned into explorers, navigators, and even archaeologists of our own simultaneous, non-simultaneous, spatially distributed present. Thank you.